Okay, we're going to start. Good morning, everybody. There, I have a call out right over here. Someone doesn't have any. Everyone needs. Okay. So the talk, the conversation, the learning that we're going to do today is focused on the notion of warfare, and to highlight some ideas that are found within secular thought, within general philosophy on warfare, contrasting it to Jewish thought on warfare. And the Makorot, the sources really focus, if you turn to the first page of the Makorot, you'll see that this is cut and pasted from a encyclopedia of philosophy, which is a wonderful encyclopedia to be able to look at. It's an encyclopedia that's online and is constantly updated. And it focuses on the notion of, this entry focuses on the notion of ethics of war and peace. And so, what I'd like to do is really just look at some of the ideas that are mentioned in the first few pages of the handout, and then move from there to a conversation about the Jewish ideas regarding the notion of just wars and different components of war. Yes? Sure, okay. It's a little crazy for me to give a lecture. For the last time I was in this room was around 30 years or 20 years ago or so, when I think taking a course in biology. It's a little, still not used to presenting in the same rooms I was a student in. Okay. So the first idea that is highlighted in this notion of the ethics of war and peace, if you turn to the first page of the handout, there are handouts right there, if you could just feel free to take. Is the idea that it's important to recognize that there is, as I've highlighted, the core and controversial proposition of just war theory is that sometimes states can have a moral justification for resorting to armed force. War is sometimes, but of course not all the time, morally right. So for example, when Chamberlain decided not to engage with Germany initially, that pacifism would be viewed in some ways as almost immoral because it led to greater challenges in the future. There are times in which, for example, World War II, when on the Allied side, where there is something known as just and good wars. There are times in which it's necessary to go to war. This idea of just war theory is found on the bottom of the first page of the handout, number two, where it highlights that this tradition it begins really in the works of Augustine and Aquinas and moves towards actually perhaps the dean of contemporary just war theory, and that is Michael Walzer, highlighting two aspects, or as we would say in Hebrew, tzvei dinim, two components to just war theory. What is the first aspect? There has to be a just reason to go to war. So if you turn to the next page of the handout, number page two, you look at what I have in the box, you'll see that this is a translation of an important work that was written by Thomas Aquinas in the 1200s, where he writes the following. I answer, and I'd like to read some of this, I answer that in order for a war to be just, three things are necessary. First, the authority of the sovereign by whose command the war is waged. In other words, It has to be that a war is not started by an individual, but it's started by the head of a country, because war should never be the business of a private individual. Secondly, if you look at the second paragraph, he says, a just cause is required, namely that those who are attacked should be attacked because they deserve it on account of some fault. In other words, there is a reason why you're going to war. Thirdly, it is necessary that the belligerents should have a rightful intention, so that they intend the advancement of good or the avoidance of evil. So the three components of just war is, number one, it has to be waged by a country or by the leader of a country. It has to be for a good reason, namely if you've been attacked or someone deserves to be attacked for a certain reason, and you have to have a rightful intention. You have to have the right kavanot, you have the right intent. This idea, if we skip the third page, I have it there because I think it's important that you read it on your own, but if you turn to the fourth page of our handout, Michael Walzer summarizes in a very interesting book, it's actually a very important book, I found it to be, it's not a book of fast reading, so if you're tired at night, this is not the book you should be reading. So on page 4, Just and Unjust Wars, you see what I have in the box. He gives examples of just reasons. So for example, when human rights are being violated in the state, as in the case of enslavement or massacre, it makes talk of a community, the right of the state, or the self-determination of the state seem cynical and irrelevant. Normally it's forbidden to enter into another country and to invade them. But when a country has decided not to take the role of its civilian population properly, there is a just reason to invade that country. So just to give you a very modern, contemporary example, what's going on in Syria. In fact, in the Republican debate of last week, you had Ron Paul basically say that it's not a just war to enter into another country. His approach, as opposed to, and again, I'm not taking sides with anyone there, as opposed to others like Newt Gingrich and others that articulated a more normative view on just war, it said that it is appropriate to think about those issues. We see here from Michael Walzer, summarizing really hundreds of years of conversations on this, that if a state has decided to massacre its citizens, humanitarian intervention is justified when it is a response to acts that shock the moral conscience of mankind. And there's a recognition, third paragraph on page 4 in the blue, or in the box, war may never achieve absolutes, complete territorial integrity, total invulnerability, or everlasting peace. The object of war is a better state of peace, and better within the confines of the argument for justice means more secure than the status quo, less vulnerable to territorial expansion, etc., etc. And finally, the fourth paragraph, in order for a soldier or civilian not to have died in vain, war must be just, a purpose that is worth dying for. A purpose that is morally urgent may include political independence, communal liberty, or the protection of human life. While working to deter a war is admirable, appeasement is not to be argued if by so doing, injustice and aggression will triumph, that is a greater evil. This is the basic Torah of the secular community, the general community, on the notion of warfare. If we turn to page 6 of our handout, as we move further, we see there's another component to just wars, not just for a just cause, but there has to be justice in the way you fight a just war. So, for example, the idea of jus bello, namely the idea that refers to justice in war, that there has to be right conduct in the midst of battle. So an example of a just war not being fought in a just way, an example of that would be when the North, in the Civil War, when Sherman burned all of Atlanta. It was a just war, one could argue, on the North's part to fight against the South, but burning the entire city of Atlanta is not a just way of fighting that just war. Okay? By the way, there are Makorot over here, if you need. Please feel free. The Makorot. Or right over here, there's Makorot. Okay? So there is this notion that there has to be a just way in which one fights a just war. So if you turn to page 7 of our handout, you'll see that there's a summary of the just ways in which a just war has to be fought. And I will just give you, I would just like to focus on what's in the box. There are times when a non-combatant's life can be put in harm's way. For Walzer, the killing of the non-combatant can never be the goal of a military operation, but rather the tragic evil consequence. A just war cannot focus on innocent civilians. Such activity, like loss of civilian life, is permitted in a war when the following four prerequisites hold true. One, the operation itself is good and a legitimate act of war. For example, if somebody puts civilians in the middle of a field of warfare, when I respond to being attacked and I kill civilians, it's a justified killing of civilians, although it is an evil consequence. The direct effect is morally acceptable when, for example, if you put military supplies in a hospital, and it's tragic if you have to destroy part of the hospital, but the bottom line is the onus is on the person who mixes war with civilians, not the person that needs to respond to it. The intention, number three, the intention of the soldier is good. He aims only at the acceptable effect and seeks to minimize any evil consequence. The good effect is significantly important to compensate for evil consequence. The idea being that just wars, one has to make sure that there's proportionality, that we are concerned about the non-combatants, we obey international laws, etc., etc. This idea is continued. These ideas of what we call just ways of fighting just wars is summarized on page 7 and on page 8. So this is all by way of introduction to the notion of how secular literature for hundreds of years have focused on the notion of just war. Two components to just war. There has to be a just reason to fight the war. We've talked about those just reasons to protect one's independence, to deal with a threat against civilians, to deal with a threat that would challenge the whole notion of protecting of civilians. And in addition, for there to be a just reason to fight a war, war has to be fought using just ways. And I gave an example of the burning of Atlanta being a just war, not fought in a just way. That's just one example, and these are the basic paradigms or protocols that are found, and there's more or less within the general community discussion of warfare. How does halakha deal with these issues? How does halakha talk about these issues of warfare, and how do we see that this issue of love and hate, or these issues within Tanakh? And that's our goal for the rest of the time. I just wanted to set it up with the understanding of that halakha also deals with these issues in a very significant way. It's very interesting, and this is not the time for us to go into it, it's very interesting that some of the greatest thinkers on issues of warfare never realized that Jewish law focuses on these issues. In fact, Michael Walzer, who himself is a Jew, and is a significant personality in the whole notion of warfare, has attacked the Jewish community, or actually the theology of the Jewish community, suggesting that the Torah and the rabbis don't really have a code of ethics for the notion of warfare. His reason for this, and we're not going to give the examples that he gives, I believe, and have actually written a paper on this that will soon be published, his reason for this is because as great as Michael Walzer is in the notion of warfare, his accessibility to materials that are written in Hebrew and not translated is limited, and therefore there's much material that he doesn't really use in coming to conclusions about the Jewish notion of warfare, and therefore he makes certain mistakes in his ideas. Professor Avi Revitsky and others have written articles in which they clearly demonstrate how Michael Walzer simply just misses a large corpus of information on the issue of the Jewish notion of warfare. And I wanted to use what we see in Tanakh and what we see in Halacha to really create and craft the loose protocols of how Halacha deals with the notion of warfare. So we start on page 9 of our handout here with what is discussed relevant to Purim, relevant to Parsha Zachar, the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek, of destroying Amalek. It's interesting how this mitzvah has some limitations that the Rambam, as well as Rav Moshe Feinstein and others, put into it. So, on page 9, source 1a, you have the psukim in Parsha Zachar. We're familiar with these psukim. Remember what happened with Amalek as you left Egypt. Asher karcha baderech, etc., etc. Timched zecher Amalek, you should destroy Amalek. Mitachas ha-shemayim lo tishkach. This is a mochama, this is a war that we consider a mochemes mitzvah. What's interesting is that the Rambam, in his codification of Milchamot, in Hilchot Melachim, he writes the following. In the first halakha of Perikei, he writes, Ein ha-melech nilcham tchila el mechemet mitzvah. The first and foremost, a melech should only fight obligated wars, biblically mandated wars, before he fights wars that are permissible but not obligatory. So when David HaMelech decides to conquer parts of Syria and other parts of the regions around Israel that are not mandated, David HaMelech loses the ability by fighting wars that were not permitted for him to fight, what we call a mechemet reshut. In David's case, it wasn't even a mechemet reshut. He loses the ability to build the Beis HaMikdash. It's what we call the Kibush Yachid. David HaMelech fights wars that are not justified, and therefore he cannot build the Beit HaMikdash. Ve'ezu hi mechemet mitzvah. What is considered an obligatory war? It's the mechama against the seven Canaanite nations, the mechama against Amalek, says the Rambam, Ve'ezra Yisrael miyatzar shabar lehem. Or when the Jewish people are attacked, the need to respond to those attacks. And then afterwards, you can fight Mechemes Reshut, and that is to expand the boundaries of the land of Israel. Look at what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, Mechemet Mitzvah, Eino Tzorech Litol Ba Reshut Beit Din. The king does not have to ask permission when fighting an obligatory war. He can leave, he can go out for that war any time, but a Mechemet Reshut, a war that is not considered obligatory, the vast majority of wars, there is a checks and balance situation. In order to make sure that the king does not fight wars and is unchecked and can fight wars without there being checks and balances to make sure that the moral compass of fighting the war, that there's a just reason to fight the war, the king has to ask the moral authority of the people, namely the Sanhedrin, the Beit Din. This is one example of there being these checks and balances between, a form of the War Powers Act, in order to make sure that before a war was fought by the king, before he used his army, he needed to get permission from the Sanhedrin. What's also extremely interesting by the Rambam, and this is not a well-known law, that the Rambam in the sixth perek writes the following. Ein osu mechama im adam ba'olam ad shekarim lo shalom. You cannot fight a war against another nation until you ask for peace. What does that mean? In other words, until you make a peaceful offering. The definition of a peaceful offering is minimally that the nation has to accept the seven Canaanite laws, the Shiva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, as well as some other things that they have to do. But the Rambam is interested when he says here, Echad Mechemet Reshut Ve'echad Mechemet Mitzvah. The Rambam writes that if you have to ask for peace, and if you ask for peace and they agree to peace, you cannot fight a war against them. And he also includes a Mechemet Mitzvah. He also includes the obligatory wars. So the Rambam actually has limited the wars against Amalek as when Amalek does not want to accept peace. According to the Rambam, this is a Chiddush, according to the Rambam, if Amalek is willing to accept peace, there's no longer a mitzvah to destroy them. If they're willing to keep the seven Canaanite laws, the seven Noahide laws, according to the Rambam, it seems that imishlimu v'kibu sheva mitzvot shenistavu b'nei Noach aleihem ein horgim behem neshama. You cannot kill even one of them. This is interesting. This is not something that is well known, but the Rambam creates this unbelievable limitation. And again, it highlights the idea that in Judaism, even the obligatory wars, there was a certain angst about fighting them, and if there could be a way in which the norms in which Amalek represents can be altered by them adopting the seven Noahide laws, according to the Shita of the Rambam, there's no longer a obligation or it's no longer permitted to engage in warfare even with Amalek. The Marsha on the next page, source number 2, actually highlights that even for a Mechemet Mitzvah in which the king does not have to ask permission, he does need to talk about his warfare strategies with the Sanhedrin, with the Supreme Court, simply in order to make sure that a just war is being fought in a just way. Rav Kook actually speaks about the same idea, that the reason why the king cannot declare war without the Sanhedrin is to make sure that there's a certain integrity to the process. And the Chazon Ish in source number 4 says that if a kingdom has already accepted the seven Noahide laws, then the additional requirements of not to engage in war, namely that they pay a tariff and a tax to the Jewish people if they live in Israel, cannot even be placed upon them. In other words, if you go to a people and you're about to create a war with them and they agree for peace, then at that point in time they have to keep the seven Noahide laws and they have to agree to pay certain taxes to the state. But if they've already accepted the seven Noahide laws before you've engaged them in conversations, then you can't. They don't even have to pay the taxes that a vassal state would have to pay to the sovereign state, namely to the king. It's an unbelievable statement. My point here is that whether it is the Rambam's limitation of a Mechemes Mitzvah, whether it is the statements that are found in the Marsha in the 1500s, whether it is the statements of the Rav Kook or the Chazon Ish, there is this interest in making sure that when warfare is fought, it is justified both in the why it's being fought and how it's being fought. This idea is highlighted also by the famous Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, Rav Chaim David Halevi, who in an article in Torah Shebaal Peh, a famous journal, in the 13th volume of Torah Shebaal Peh on page 178, writes that the court would examine in a fundamental way the king's request for authority to go to war to determine if it were justified and what degree of risk it entailed, and in accordance with assessment it would or would not grant his request. This is just summarizing everything we just said. Professor Aviezer Ravitsky also highlights this idea. He says nothing more than we've already talked about, and that is, in order to make sure that the king was not alone in making these decisions, that not all power fell with one person, there was checks and balances to make sure a just war was truly just, and therefore needed to ask permission of the Sanhedrin. What is extremely interesting is the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who normally does not speak about issues of a national perspective for the state of Israel, and does not normally speak on national issues, unlike the poskim in Eretz Yisrael, whether it's Tzitz Eliezer, who wrote a whole book on these issues, or others, a whole sefer on these issues, or others, all the Israeli poskim speak on national issues because they're not dealing just with the Jewish people, they're dealing with the Jewish state. Diaspora poskim, for the most part, never spoke about national issues. This is one tshuva where Rav Moshe Feinstein deviates from the norm. And he actually creates a stricture on the fighting of Amalek that's even stronger and more limiting than the Rambam. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes the following, and we'll just read the piece that I have underlined. Ma shani sover she'inyan nechama, that when it comes to war, kivin she'nogei l'pekuach nefesh, since it is pekuach nefesh, sarach tzivui miyuchad, you need a direct order, v'urim v'tumim v'sanhedrin, and you need almost a divine permission, namely urim v'tumim, namely the Kohen Gadol and the Sanhedrin. Af b'mechemes mitzvah, even with a mechemet mitzvah, a obligatory war, k'mechemet Amalek, like mechemet Amalek. So Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying is, it's an unbelievable statement by Rav Moshe. He's totally alone in this perspective, but he's still Rav Moshe Feinstein, so when he's still totally alone, it's significant. He says that fighting Amalek, even though it's a mitzvah from the Torah, you needed permission from the Sanhedrin and from the Kohen Gadol, informing that almost that there was some divine permission for a mitzvah that's already stated within the Torah. He says, "Umuchrach mizeh." That's why he explains, "Mahad the David b'Shlomo b'chol malachim atzadikim lo yatzu lilachem b'Amalek." This is why we never see in Tanakh that the kings fought Amalek, because they didn't get divine permission. "Zeh davar barur umuchrach." This is an obvious thing. Barur umuchrach. Shelo shayach l'flogal zeh, that no one can argue with, even though he says it only by himself. "Barak kishenaflo akum Yisrael." Only when the Jewish people are attacked, like in the case of Antiochus, Melech Yavan, Uchadoma, and others like that, the Havel HaTzalah, Asum Milchama B'Bayit Sheni. And in the Second Temple period, when there was no Urim V'Tumim, when there was no of that divine peace, obviously the only wars that they fought were defensive wars. So here you have actually Rav Moshe Feinstein, in some ways, minimizing in a significant way the mitzvah we're going to read. Again, all by his lonesome, the mitzvah that we're going to read next week in the Sharva Zachar, and that even Amalek, even though it says, remember this responsibility, Rav Moshe says, it only is a halachic responsibility if there is divine permission at that moment, as well as permission from the Sanhedrin. There's an issue of lo b'shamayim hi, and things of that nature. It could be that the Urim V'Tumim was not giving permission, but more was indicating whether it would be a successful outcome. Because sometimes you have to do something even if it's not going to be successful. But the point being that Rav Moshe Feinstein is clear that even for a mechemes mitzvah, there is a checks and balance system. There is just wars need to be done to ensure that they're just. There needs to be checks and balances. This is a very strong, significant approach that we find, whether it's in the Rambam, who says that you have to ask for shalom, for peace, before you fight any war, or Rav Moshe, who is again, you know, on his own on this issue, who requires there to be something a little bit more aggressive than that. Yes?
The types of justice that the medieval authorities are referring to is somewhat different than, you know, let's say what Walter is discussing.
Explain?
Well, you know, justice in the Rambam is, are they eating every lechai? You know, are they...
No, there's also the putting up, there's also the establishment of a court system. So
right.
That civilians can go through a due process. That's part of the Shevet Mitzvah.
Within a halakhic context, which is defined by the Jewish...
No, the court system does not have to rule using halakha. The court system has to rule in a normative way. The fact that you have to set up that in order to fulfill the mitzvah, the Shevet Mitzvah Bnei Noach, there has to be a justice system.
Give me my point. I'm going to take it from another perspective. The idea that the idea of a vassal state. I mean,
right.
We don't accept the idea of a vassal state in our society,
right.
Global society today. So, while the Rambam may be stating that there is concept of a just war, the details of that are somewhat different to us than, you know, you're continually conflating numerous centuries of thought into what.
But keep in mind again the tshuva of Moshe, the statement by the Chazon Ish that says that once a community has accepted Shevet Mitzvot Bnei Noach, even those additional requirements are no longer accepted. But the bottom line is yes, it is not peace in the way we are familiar with peace. In other words, if you feel that there is a responsibility to attack a nation and you create shalom, it means seven Noahide laws plus tariffs and taxes. Yes, that's true. And that maybe in our society would not be fully acceptable. And I recognize that fact. Although, again, without being able to fully, develop this thought, because quite honestly I didn't think about it, there have been many times in our contemporary society where nations have had or small countries have had responsibilities to larger countries as protectorates and things of that nature where they had responsibilities. But my point is that what I'm just trying to show you that what we assume as total permission to engage in warfare for the Amalek situation, where we're taught that, you see that Rav Moshe Feinstein has created the significant limitation, and you see that even the Rambam has created a limitation, that there is the need to act in peace before you act in war. And I think that is an important conversation regarding the notion of how we fight wars, which I think, without recognizing the synergy between the oral tradition and the Tanakh, we would not be familiar with. And I think that's the point I'd like to make. Yes?
When you say just war, it's the way we define just. For example, Hamashem Amalek Midor.
Right.
200, 300, 1,000 years later, is still obligated to have this war with them. This is not absolute morality. This is the way we're justifying just.
Meaning?
Most nations will agree that if somebody did something wrong to us 3,000 years ago,
right,
we have a right to go and kill it at any time that we want. And in terms of absolute morality, it would not be accepted. It's just the way we're defining it. That's why just the word.
Okay, I think that there are definitely, the notion of just war changes in generations. My first point is the recognition of the fact that halakha has this notion of just war. My second piece is, I would remind you, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that there's a whole conversation about the fact that Sancheirev was still mixed the nations, yet even though Sancheirev mixed the nations, so we don't know who Amalek is, we're still told that it's a mitzvah to destroy Amalek. So how is there a mitzvah still to destroy Amalek if Sancheirev destroyed the nation, mixed the nation, so we don't know who Amalek is? So there's a famous, what?
It's a concept.
Right, so there's a famous conversation about this concept that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is famous for developing, and that is that Amalek is not just a people, but rather it's a group of individuals whose entire raison d'etre is to destroy the Jewish people. And in that case, there is a permission, because that's considered a defensive war, to respond to them. My point is that, again, my point, I think within the whole notion of warfare, morality is subjective. What was moral at one time is not this definition of moral in our time. And I think halakha has a certain fluidity that allows for it. The notion of the seven Noahide laws and the creation of a court system is reflective of the morality of the current period of time. But what is, I think, important in the conversation is to recognize that even the wars that we are familiar with, the ones like Amalek that we are told, Midor Lador, to destroy, etched within those who codify those ideas, in particular the Rambam, is the recognition of the fact that there are limitations even on those wars. My point being that there is a notion of how even mandatory wars, just wars, are fought, and I think it's important that we bring that point across in our looking at how halakha deals with the notion of warfare. This idea, one second, let me just go on a little bit more. This idea is not just about the fighting of wars, but also about the way, the conduct that we have within warfare itself. And that is found on page 12 of our handbook. The first idea is that to recognize, as we're told in Sefer Devarim, Bahaya Machanecha Kadosh, that the first idea is we have to realize that our camps need to be holy. That we have to, when we're engaged in warfare, there has to be just conduct. And in fact, the first place that we see this idea of just conduct being highlighted is when Rashi and the Maharal, one of the commentaries on Rashi, picks up an idea that it says in source 2 on this page, on page 12, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od, that Yaakov is very fearful, Vayitzer Lo. And it seems to be also that he's fearful again. So Rashi, in source 2a, asks, Vayira Vayitzer, why is it, what does it mean that he's fearful and he's concerned? So Rashi says, Vayira, that he's afraid, Shema Yahareh, that he'll be killed, Vayitzer Lo, in Yarog Losacherim, that maybe he'll kill others. That he is afraid that he'll be killed, he'll afraid he'll kill others. So the Maharal asks the question, I don't understand. Why is he afraid about killing others? Esav is coming to kill him. Why is he afraid? We know the law is that Hashkein Laharkacha, someone who comes to kill you, you're allowed to respond. So if you look at the first column of this Maharal, the last two words if you look on the right column, third to the last line, last two words, the Efshar Lomar. Again, right column, third to the last line, last two words, right after the footnote there, the Efshar Lomar. The Shema Lo Bolo Haroget Yaakov, he was afraid, he was concerned that maybe they didn't come to kill Yaakov. Afogav the Esav Hevi Otamimo, even though Esav brought them with them, Mishum Hayira Bo'u. They were afraid not to go with Esav, that Esav would kill them, and therefore they came. Avolo ba'u laharog. They didn't come to kill Yaakov. Yaakov, v'nei shelo yada in ba'u laharog olo, hayem mitarei shema yarog otam shelo kedin. He was afraid he'd kill them, shelo kedin, not permissible. So the Maharal says, what do you mean? Even if they went because they were intimidated, but if a band is coming to attack you, it's not your job to check which ones came because they're intimidated, which ones came because they really want to kill you. You have a right to kill them. So the Maharal explains, yes, that's true, but there was a moral concern that Yaakov had above the halachic permissibility to kill them. There was a moral issue that he was still concerned with, even though halachically it was permitted for him to respond with full force. To kill them, that he felt that perhaps they came and they were intimidated, and he was concerned that in battle he would destroy them also. This is the beginning of a conversation regarding our responsibility in warfare. We recognize in warfare that we are responsible for the safety of the soldiers as well as the safety of perhaps innocent people that might get involved within a theater of warfare that don't deserve to be killed. But the bottom line is the Maharal is painting in more agadic terms, not in the halachic terms, but agadic terms, the idea that Yaakov was not only afraid that his family would be killed, but he was afraid of the fact that maybe he would kill, perhaps halachically justified, that he would kill people who weren't bent on killing him. This is why in source number 4, on the next page, the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim introduces an idea that is found within the Torah, but the Rambam highlights the idea that when we lay siege to a city for the purpose of capture, we do something that does not make logical sense. And that is, we allow there to be a corridor through which the non-combatants can escape. It's almost like the idea that happens now in the Israeli army, in which they will shower an area with leaflets before they go there to warn the non-combatants that they're about to engage in warfare there. This idea that there is a corridor or a total open area in which people can escape in order to leave the theater of warfare. This is highlighting this idea that not only does Jewish tradition highlight, admittedly, that the sense of morality changes in time, but doesn't only highlight the notion of a just war, but also the conduct in which we engage in the just war is also concerning. We see that with our patriarch Yaakov, but in more halachic terminology, we see that in source 4 on page 13 with the Rambam in Hilchot Malachim. We also see it in other places. We see it, for example, in a city of idol worshippers. The halakha is the following. If you have a city of idol worshippers, where everybody has decided to worship idols, Jews decided to worship idols, then that city has to be destroyed. These statements are found in Sefer Devarim. We're told the following, source number 5. When you hear one of the cities that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given to you, that there is a knowledge, Nelchav, and Abda, Elohim Acherim, let us serve other gods, Ashulah Yidatem, which we don't know, but the Rashta V'chakarta V'sha'alta Hekev, and you check it out, you see it's true, Hakei Takesh Yoshvei Ir, Hahi, destroy those people, Lefi Charev, by the sword, destroy all those Jews, and kill their animals. But the Rambam, in his discussion of this issue, is very interesting. The Rambam is very concerned about how we do this. How do we kill all of these individuals? So look at the Rambam on page 13, source 6. The Rambam, we can move to page 14 because I have it in English there. What is the procedure in the case of a seduced city in Irei Dahas? When it is in a condition to be declared a seduced city, the Supreme Court sends a commission. The Supreme Court's involved with deciding wars, through whom it institutes an inquiry, an inquisition, till the judges are convinced on clear evidence that all or the greater part of a city's population has been led astray and relapsed into idolatry. In other words, the minute they hear that the majority of the population are idol worshippers, what do they do next? Then they send to them two scholars to warn them and to try to bring them back to the right path. So the first thing they do afterwards is they send a Kiruv group, right? They send two people, Kiruv personalities, been trained by Yeshiva University in Kiruv, and they go out and they try to bring them back. First of all, that's not found within the Shulchan Aruch. That's not found within the Torah. The Torah says if you find the majority of the people, and you know that's the case, you have to destroy them. It's clear that that's not the first thing you do. The first thing you do after that is you have to try to do Kiruv. If they repent, it is well, and that's it. But if they persist in their folly, the court charges all Israel to organize an expedition against them. They lay siege to and wage war upon them till the city is taken by storm. After it has been taken, a large number of tribunals, courts of three, are set up to try the inhabitants. Anyone against two witnesses come and testify that he worshipped idols after having been warned is set apart, and those people are destroyed. In other words, now what happens is, not only do you ask first for them to go through tshuva, but then what you do is, you have to bring everyone in front of a court. After you bring them in front of a court, you have to see if there are two halakhically kosher witnesses, which is really pretty hard to find if the whole city is worshipping idols, because none of those people are kosher to be edim. If all who worship idols are found to be a minority of the inhabitants, then they are stoned and the rest are saved. So the extra rules and scrutiny that are created just highlights, I think, the idea that the concern or the issues mentioned in the Torah regarding the sanctity of life are of such concern that despite the fact the Torah does not have those pieces in it, etched within the Torah Shabbat is a full litany of responsibilities. You find there to be a majority. After you find there to be a majority, you have to send in a Kiruv team. After the Kiruv team isn't successful, then you have to basically test every single one to make sure there are two witnesses. If after you find two witnesses and they happen then to be a majority of the people, then there are protocols that have to be done. It's a pretty robust protocol. In fact, the Ramah, not Ramosha Isselis, one of the Rishonim, in source number 7, has an unbelievable thing. Unbelievable statement. V'otamiyali, look at bottom of page 14. V'otamiyali, the Amar, making as kol taf, as kol anashim lefi charet. Why does it say, how can the Torah tell us that you kill all the children and the women? What are we talking about with the women? If they are idol worshippers, then they are no different than the men. Men and women are equal. If they're both idol worshippers, they're both idol worshippers. If the women didn't worship idols and their men and their husbands did, why should the women get blamed for that? And look at the second statement he says. And this he got lambasted by, but he says it. Vatu, dikamar, making as kol taf, you destroy the children? It's hard to even to read. V'chalila la'el merasha. Woe would it be for us to have such an evil God Could we find, how would our God legislate something so wicked? Where do we see a child responsible for theological beliefs? So my, yes? I'm well aware of it. And I'm sure this Rishon actually took a course in Tanakh also. So he's familiar with it also. If it wasn't unbelievable, I wouldn't be bringing it to you. If it wasn't like unbelievable, then how could this Rishon make this comment? It's totally against Pshat. It's totally against what it says in Tanakh. And that's why I'm bringing it down. I'm bringing it down to show you that that you have Rishonim that are so concerned about the ethics, the Judaism within warfare, that despite the fact that there is this clear pasuk within the Torah, which you have articulated so beautifully, and I'm sure this Rishon knew the same pasuk, he's nevertheless making this comment. And this is not like some, you know, tangential personality. This is a Rishon that is viewed within the Masorah, which is viewed as a significant personality and leader within that community. I even put in a little bio about him. My point being here is to point out the fact, whether it's the Rambam who is more normative than this Rishon, or this Rishon, you're seeing here the process in which the concern about the conduct within warfare was so acute that you have comments being found within the Masorah that are stronger than what is being dictated just within the Tanakh. And since this is a Yom Iyun on Tanakh, my goal really is to show how the notion of war is looked at in, or mentioned in Tanakh, and how Rishonim codified within Halakha and actually put the brakes on some of the significant statements which are said within Tanakh. Yes? We're going to get to that in 1 minute. Great question. We'll get to that in 1 minute. This idea is also highlighted more on page 15, where we see the limits of destruction, where we see, for example, the idea of not that you're not allowed to destroy forests and other parts of nature in order to protect soldiers, in order to be able to be successful in warfare, but you're not allowed to do it just simply to do it. You don't just burn down a forest to make a statement. If you need to destroy a forest to succeed in warfare, you can do it. But just to do it in order to destroy and to scorch the earth is not halakhically permitted. Just conduct requires there to be a limit in the destruction. To succeed in warfare is permitted. To do it just to do it is not. That's highlighted on page 15, sources 1 and 2. Now to the question that was just asked about Shaul. In September of 1982, we're familiar with the Lebanon War and the massacre that happened in Sabra and Shatila. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was greatly concerned of the fact that there was initially no interest in doing a VOD, an appropriate investigation about how the massacres were allowed to happen if the Israeli army was basically there. And while it has been proven that the Israeli army was not involved in the massacres, but they were around when it happened, and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein felt that there needed to be some type of VOD, some type of investigation that was done regarding this issue of non-combatants, if you can call them non-combatants. And again, I'm not taking sides here. You have to look at the literature. Non-combatants being killed or if they're non-combatants, one could say being murdered. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in Hatzofeh on Erev Shabbat, that's the, you know, the Sunday in Israel from the perspective of that's when the newspapers are the bulkiest. In Hatzofeh, on page 18 of our handout, I have a copy of it. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and I highlighted the pieces that I think are interesting and important. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, on page 5 of Hatzofeh, wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister asking for there to be a formal investigation of of what happened with the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein explains in his statements there that we have the mitzvah of Eglah Rufa, that if there's death that happens and we're unfamiliar with who committed the act, that there has to be a whole protocol, a process that the wise men, the leaders of the community, have to be involved in. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in this article explains that the Eglah Arufa, according to most Rishonim, is not only when a Jew is murdered and we're not aware of who was involved with the act, but even a non-Jew. He speaks about the dark cloud that hangs over the Jewish people without an investigation, how it compromises the light of the Jewish people within the international community, how it's a Chilah Hashem, how we have a responsibility of evaluation our activities, how he explains that there is an al-chait, shakatana lefanecha b'chozek yad, that we've sinned with the use of strength. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein asks the question, is it forbidden to use strength? Of course it's permitted to use strength. But when strength is used inappropriately, then we have to reflect upon the use of strength. And Rav Aaron goes into a whole thing about how his students, the soldiers of the Israeli army, who give up every single day, both objectively and subjectively, give up of themselves, how it's unfair to them to be called, as they are so courageously, to protect the state of Israel, that there should be a cloud over their head when they give so much l'shem shamayim and l'shem the nitzchias, the eternality of Klal Yisrael. So Rav Aaron has this whole piece where he focuses on chazarat ha'gaiva halumit, the responsibility to return the pride to the nation and the standing to the Jewish people or to the state of Israel. In a English translation, where he doesn't translate this whole article, or I would have not summarized these pieces for you, on page 16, in an article that he writes, he asks the following question, which I've been always moved by, and I'd like to just read it to you. So he mentions that he has his open letter to the Prime Minister, and he asks the following. I ask, and he writes this in the article, why was it that King Shaul was punished for not killing Agag, the king of Amalek? Was it simply for not having killed the last remaining member of Amalek? So Rav Lichtenstein says, I suggested that he was punished not just for sparing Agag, but because the fact that he refused to kill Agag placed in a totally different light his killing of all the other Amalekim beforehand. He goes on, he says the following. Shaul had been commanded to take a whole people and kill them, and this is morally a frightful thing. The only justification lies in it being a response to an unequivocal divine command. Therefore, if Shaul had been motivated in his actions purely by fear of God, by obedience to the tzav, to the commandment, then he should have followed the command to the letter, basically to the letter of the law. God didn't say, kill Amalek, but spare Agag. Now, if he didn't kill Agag, but killed everybody else, what does that indicate? And here's Rav Lichtenstein's unbelievable insight. It indicates that what motivated Shaul in killing the others, namely the Amalekim, was not the tzav, was not the command of God, but rather some baser impulse, some instinctive violence. And the proof is that he killed everyone but spared his peer, his royal comrade. If that is the case, then Shaul was not punished for sparing Agag. Rather, he had to be punished because of the Amalekites he did kill. In other words, Rav Lichtenstein says, Shaul's punishment was not for sparing Agag, but the minute he spared one Amaleki and he killed the rest of the nation, then his act of killing the rest of the nation was not an act in commandment of God, by God, but rather was a debased act, and therefore he's punished for killing all of the Amalekim. Because he killed them not purely due to a divine command, which is the only thing that can overcome the moral consideration, but rather out of military, diplomatic, or political considerations. A very powerful statement by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He highlights this idea also in Hebrew in his letter to the Prime Minister, and I think it again speaks to the point that we've been talking about here heretofore. This idea is no more communicated than in page 19, in which I have for you a letter in which a soldier writes a letter and leaves it when he entered Lebanon. And this again is a very recent letter from 2009, when the soldier went in after they needed to go into Lebanon, and he writes a whole letter about he was in this person's home, and he writes how he took care of his home, no different. He saw the computer, he covered it, he made sure nothing was destroyed, he did the best of his ability, and he explains this whole letter, which I would ask you to read. And I want to just conclude with a story. Baruch Hashem, Yeshiva University has a strong relationship with the chief rabbi's office in Israel, as well as with the Tzohar rabbis and with the leadership of Tzohar. In fact, the spiritual leader of Tzohar, Rav Ariel, the chief rabbi, Rav Adgan, actually spoke to Kolo Medreshet Yom Rishon, and it's not last week, 2 weeks ago. Last week? Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Whatever it was. Recently, he spoke. So, and in fact, he spent 4 days here, and he said to me, as he left, he said, I walked in here realizing, and we all agree with that, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, the Torah comes from Israel and from Yerushalayim, but I walked out of YU realizing that there's a lot for us in Sion and Yerushalayim to learn from Yeshiva University. And the relationship that we have with Tzohar is very important to us. We are their junior partners, and I stress the word junior, partners in helping them develop rabbis in the communities in Israel, what we call Reshit Smichat Kehilatenu. There's a lot of important conversations between the chief rabbi's office. We actually, for the first time, have a Yeshiva University rabbinic intern in the chief rabbi's office, in Rav Amar's office, and as well as our relationship with Tzohar. In 2009, the relationship has been for a few years already. I remember a conversation I had with Rav David Stav, who is not only the Rosh Hashiva in Petah Tikva, not only one of the heads of Tzohar, but the rabbi in Shoham. And he had just gotten a phone call from some of his students who were in Lebanon, who called them with a shaila. The shaila was that they were hungry, they had not gotten their food, and they wanted to know if they could take food. They were in an Arab's home, and there were fruit outside. They wanted to know if they could pull the fruit off the Arab's tree, whether they could take it and eat the fruit, and if they could take it, did they have a responsibility, because maybe it was considered stolen, did they have a responsibility to say a bracha or not? And he was sharing with me his response to them, being that they're permitted to take the fruit, only enough to keep them awake through the night, through Shmirah, and that they should make a bracha. And the truth is, the answer to the question isn't important. The truth is, what's important is the fact that the question was asked. And I think that we should remember this, Derachecha Darchei Noam V'chol Netivotav Shalom, that not only are we blessed with an army that follows these rules and these regulations, and we always have to make sure that when there seems to be blips on the screen, that they need to be investigated and evaluated and not ignored. But this has been the tradition of the Jewish people for thousands of years. That even statements that are found in Tanakh, like the statement about killing children, is challenged by Rishonim. And whether you accept the challenge or not is not important. What's important is that the challenge and the conversation happens. And this notion of a just war and the notion of the activities that in which we fight a war, it's important to recognize that halakha has always been sensitive to that. It's important to recognize